Included a very special holiday that a lot of people were pretty excited about. It was Back to the Future Day, which is an event that's been scheduled since, when did that come out? 86, 85, something like that? Last time the Royals won the World Series? Yeah, that's when it came out. Weird. I'm not saying they've won yet. 3-1. I like their odds. But Back to the Future Day was the day that Marty McFly and Doc Brown went forward to in time to fix the present that got messed up because of time travel. It all makes perfect sense. But if you can understand the plot to Back to the Future 2, you can completely understand the passage that we're going to be looking at today. Because if I remember right, and it's been a couple decades since I've seen this, the deal was that Biff Tannen, I think that's the name of the bad guy in the show. I could have Googled that beforehand. That would have been a good idea in general preparation. But I spent so much time in the Bible. So, see the way I flipped that around to make myself look good. So Biff got his hands on an almanac from the future, and then he used that to bet on games, knowing the outcome, and it made him a ton of money. And then when Marty and Doc had to go and solve that problem, Biff and his family became very threatened because they were cutting into his income. And then hilarity ensues. And also, there were hoverboards, which we did not get. Come on, science. You had one job and 30 years to do it. Make us hoverboards. And we got, slightly better video games? I'm just very dissatisfied. I'm hoping in 30 more years, I can have my hoverboard and my flying car, which would come with no safety concerns whatsoever. So what we're looking at in Acts chapter 16, really, it's basically that plot just without the DeLorean. Very simple. Here's what we've got. We're going to be looking at a story where, I don't know how she did it, but there was this slave girl who could see the future and made her owners very, very rich by knowing stuff that was coming and giving advice and predictions that people were willing to pay a lot of money for. And then that source of income becomes threatened, and things get weird. Or I could have just read the passage. So Acts 16, starting in verse 16, as you're turning over there, you'll remember that Paul and Silas and Timothy and, though not mentioned by name, but because we can tell by the use of personal pronouns, Luke, are all on this trip into what today we would call Europe for the first time. So they went on this second missionary journey. They went into Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. They went and revisited a bunch of churches from their first missionary journey and relayed all of the stuff that was found and discussed at the Jerusalem Council. So the whole question of how much circumcising you have to do in order to be a Christian has been settled. There's a few social issues that have been resolved so that people can sit and eat dinner with Christians who are from a completely different background. Paul, Silas, Timothy, Luke go around. They communicate this stuff to people. And then they figure, hey, when in Turkey, tell people about Jesus. So they start doing that, but it just doesn't work. We don't know exactly how it didn't work, but we know that the origin of their failure was from God. God didn't want to preach the gospel there at that moment. Now, those same people got reached shortly after the fact, but he had something else in mind for them. Paul has this vision of a guy in Macedonia, which is north of Greece, still north of modern-day Greece, and they decide that what that means is that God wants them to saddle up and go into Europe, and so they make their way first to Philippi. They get there. They look for a synagogue. There isn't one because there aren't enough Jewish men, so they go out to a place of prayer, it's called, by this river outside of town. They meet a lady named Lydia, and the Lord opens her heart to respond to the message of Jesus. She does respond. She's baptized. She invites him to stay with her, and that's going to be their base of operations while they follow through on this supernatural call to go to Macedonia and see what happens. So that's where we pick it up in verse 16. Once, when we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. She earned a great deal of money for her owners by fortune-telling. This girl followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so troubled that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her. When the owners of the slave girl realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. They brought them before the magistrates and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. After they'd been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Upon receiving such orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, I know that there are weeks when we get ready to do the whole sermon thing, and you're thinking, what is there even to talk about in this passage? Oh, this is going to be rough. And then, you know, we try. And then there are weeks like this. Oh boy, is there a lot here. So let's have some fun. What I think we're going to discover as we tear into this passage is that there are just some fascinating little historical and cultural details that we can tear into that are going to illuminate this passage, help us understand it more like the original audience would have. But I also think there's some really fantastic practical implications for you and I reading it today. So let's have some fun. Right off the bat, it seems that this is a chronologically appropriate passage to be looking at because we're talking about spirits and mystical things that we don't understand. So happy bonus Halloween. Once when we were going to a place of prayer, so that's back out to that river where they met Lydia, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit by which she predicted the future. Does anybody in your translation, I'm using the NIV here, it's not necessarily the God-ordained translation, it's just one of many. Does anybody have a different word for spirit in your translation? Anything? Are we all literally going NIV? Spirit? We got spirit? Some of the oldest translations will use the term pythonic spirit. You might catch that in your footnotes. Sometimes there'll still be a translation note about that. That can be a really interesting and confusing thing. And if you want to just have your head spin a little bit, you can go and check that out on the Googles. But this spirit, it's not the same word that Luke employs for the spirits that we've seen possessing people in the Gospel of Luke. There's something different going on here. Now, pythonic spirit, as Luke originally labeled that, it means nothing to us. We have no social, historical, cultural context for this at all, but that would have jumped off the page to the original audience because the original audience would have included a bunch of Greeks who would have recognized that the pythonic spirit is the spirit of fortune telling. Here's what I mean by that. To get this, we got to talk Greek mythology. So this is going to be fun. Oh, and I brought pictures. Do we have pictures? Can we do pictures? I don't know. Let's see. We get the map first. Let's do the map. Hey, we're back to the map. Okay. You see where the H is in Achaia, right there above Corinth? That is about where we're talking about when I describe Mount Parnassus. Anybody ever heard of Mount Parnassus? Let's grab the next picture. That is Mount Parnassus. And being from, you know, family from Wyoming, growing up in Colorado, when I travel overseas, mountains don't impress me because, I mean, oh, how lovely, West Virginia. Look at your bumps that you labeled mountains. Really, you came up with names for every one of those hills. Oh, that's charming. But when I went here, there are two places I've been overseas that really dazzled me with their mountains. One, the Alps, apparently, they were good. Yep, all right, I can see why everybody's impressed. And that mountain, not Greece in general, just that mountain. This picture does not do justice to how freakishly gigantic and weird this mountain is in the Greek landscape. It's all mountainous and rugged. This is looking at it almost from the direction of where the Battle of Thermopylae happened between King Leonidas and the Persians, Esther's husband, Xerxes. But when you look at this thing, it you come around the first bend and you see it, and it's just staggering. There are two other places I've seen that cause the same kind of reaction for me, and one is going over Togedy. When you get that first view of the Tetons, lots of nodding, you know what I'm talking about. And the other one is when you go up out of Missoula and drop down into St. Ignatius and the Mission Mountains up there. That first view of those Mission Mountains has the same effect. It's just, the vertical rise is unbelievable. And it's so different than anywhere you've ever been. My point in showing you this is to say the place feels like it would be a home for gods. It feels like there would be something eerie or different or mythological here. Well, the Greeks thought the same thing, apparently, as soon as they saw it. We got the next picture? On Mount Parnassus. Oh, sweet. This is an awesome video I took. I did that just myself. That professional camera work is me. So we're up halfway on Mount Parnassus. That's my friend Aaron. He didn't know he was going to be in this. What you're looking at down there, can you pause it for me for a second? Or just back it up a touch. What you're looking at here is the ruins of the city of Delphi. Who's heard of Delphi? That rings a bell. Oh, wow. Y'all are smart. Maybe I'll just stop and move on because you got this whipped. Delphi is the mystical oracle city of the classical Greeks. And so anything you've seen that depicts classical Greek culture with, you know, all the gods and all of this stuff, where the hero or the main character has to go and get advice on what to do, this is where they're going. Can you run that for me one more time? This is an arena at the very top of the temple complex in Delphi. Right as we cut down, right about now. There, that's a good look, right there. Okay, so what you're seeing here is the temple of Apollo. These ruins here. This thing is at minimum 2,600 years old. Probably this is an addition to things that were already there. And anytime you see a story with a hero who needs to go get some advice in Greece, this is where they were. So if you've seen 300, and you remember the scene where the horrible, like, acne-covered creepers in the Assassin's Creed outfits are given advice, and there's the lady who gets surrounded by all this fog and stuff, and see, that's here. Hercules, remember Disney's Hercules? He goes and gets advice? That's here. Clash of the Titans, I don't remember it because it's my first movie ever, literally, was Clash of the Titans, but surely, because it always happens. This was part of Greek culture, the same way that in a Kendrick Brothers Christian film from the last 10 years, at some point around Act 2, the main character is going to be broken down and turn to God to pray. So Greek characters would reach a point where they just couldn't do it on their own and they had to go and consult the oracle. What is the oracle? Well, the oracle is the place of connection between the world of the Greek gods as they imagine it and the world of men and women. And people would go there to consult with this medium, or a go-between, between the realm of the gods and the realm of men and women. And what would happen is they'd pay a handsome sum of money, and for the longest time, three of these priestesses, Pythias is what they were called, would, they believe, channel the spirit of either Apollo, the son of Zeus, or the serpent guardian of this sacred space that Apollo is said to have killed with his arrows, which is Python. The snakes that are called pythons are named for that dragon serpenty thing from Greek mythology. Now, historians have tried to figure out why here. What's the deal? We got some more pictures. Let's keep going. There's your temple of Apollo. And we keep going. That's a good look at the whole Apollo temple complex. This is specifically exactly where the oracles would have been, and where people would come to get this advice. And there are suggestions that there are gases or herbs or what, but it doesn't answer the question, how did they get things right about the future? I mean, just getting a little buzz from some weird gas that comes out of the ground still just makes you feel weird, I would guess. How do you know the future? So there's something really strange about this for me as I look at it as a Christian who obviously rejects all of Greek mythology, but I have to acknowledge, well, the Greeks didn't reject it. And then it comes up in the Bible right here. So when Luke says pythonic spirit, he doesn't just mean your random run-of-the-mill demon who has no name and has no point, who he just comes into contact with and then Jesus casts out. You see, they went to Greece, or Macedonia, same thing at this point. They went to Greece, and their first encounter with the supernatural in Greece is an encounter with the spirit of the son of the Greek god. Are you starting to connect the dots with where I'm going here? Apollo is the spirit or the god behind the spirit by which this girl was said to be prophesying. So they are here to confront the son of Zeus, who came to earth and defeated the spirit of earth and now gives prophetic messages in the name of the son of the one true god who took on flesh and came to earth and is in the process of defeating sin and the spirit of the earth that is causing destructive and horrible things in the name of redemption and the glory of his father. We would never catch this just reading through this text because 2,000 years. Original audience would have been like, oh, that's a collision course. Today, the 6-0 Green Bay Packers face the 6-0 Denver Broncos. It is very unlikely that the Denver Broncos can win that football game because of how vastly superior Aaron Rodgers is in his prime as compared to my aging friend Peyton Manning, who graduated from high school and college the exact same year as I did. There's a reason that most of us aren't in the NFL. But in the same way that if you know football, you know, ooh, 6-0 team versus 6-0 team at this point in the season, that's a big game. That's important. So everybody at this point would be like, oh, man, undefeated son of God versus undefeated son of God. This is a showdown. Is it the son of the Greek God who matters, or is it the son of the God of the Jews, the son of the God of Abraham who matters? There is so much more to this confrontation than just this little shouting match that occurs. So this Pythonic spirit, there's your background on it, but it raises another question that I think we got to deal with before we move on from verse 16. And we will get through the whole thing, I promise. But the King James Version will call spirits like this in both the Old Testament and the New Testament familiars. It's not a Hebrew term, it's not a Greek term, it's a Latin term. But familiar is something you'll see in old translations to refer to people who had a familiar spirit, a spirit of an animal, a spirit of something supernatural that they felt they could harness and control to accomplish things. Do I think most of this is a hoax? Yeah, I think most of it is. But I'm not ready to write off all of it. And the reason for that is, why would God over 30 times condemn those kinds of practices in the Old Testament and a handful in the New Testament if it just weren't a thing at all? Why would it even come up? Now, we live in the age of science. We've lived in the age of science for several hundred years. We just don't see much like this that can really be quantified. And so probably most of you, like me, are highly skeptical of any kind of claim about the supernatural in terms of demons or spirits or ghosts or things like that. And I think that skepticism is merited. But at least at this moment in history, there was some legitimate threat to this. It looks like to me, even though the biblical record is so thin on this kind of material, it looks to me like Satan, the enemy of God, fallen angel, who desires to see God's plans thwarted and people destroyed, employs these tactics, especially at the times we're looking at here, to create human agents, the same way God seeks human agents to be ambassadors of his kingdom, to do destructive things. And so God forbids it in no uncertain terms throughout the Old Testament. But would this girl be earning money if she didn't have any power? I mean, it's so easy to just write this off and say, well, people back then were idiots, and so they believed in stupid stuff. But there's a double-edged sword here, folks. If you want to say that we depend on the testimony of smart, reliable people who lived 2,000 years ago to get a trustworthy and accurate explanation of who Jesus was and what he did because they were smart and they knew what they were doing and they could remember stuff, and then as soon as we run into anything we don't like or that makes us uncomfortable, we want to turn around and say, well, people back then were so dumb and superstitious. Well, which one is it? I'll tell you what I think. As an historian, I think people throughout most of history have been really very smart. When we picture ourselves going back in history, we picture ourselves strolling in our fancy outfits and dazzling them with our smartphone and them all falling at our feet and worshiping us like Ewoks to C-3PO because they're all so stupid back then. But they weren't stupid. These people were crazy smart. These Greek people who believed this stuff, do you know what things they thought of before us? Elemental theory. They came up with atomic theory 600 years before this happened. Do you know when we figured out atomic theory? Like 400 years ago. That was smart. They figured out, one, they knew the earth was round. They figured out how many miles around it was 400 years before this time. Do you know when we figured that out? Like with certainty, a couple hundred years ago. These people are not idiots. These are brilliant people who were masters of their language and their craft. They understood the physical world very well. Here's what I would put toward you. I think this is legitimate. I don't think this was a hoax or a game or a gimmick. I think somehow, some way, this girl genuinely was able to tap into some kind of power. I do not think this power was from God. So what does that leave us with? Darkness. Somehow, this is connected to the power of darkness. But this Greek darkness sounds a lot like the darkness we've run into with other characters who are in possession of humans. Going on to verse 17. This girl followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved." Well, that sounds familiar. Join me in Luke chapter 4. In the synagogue, verse 33, there was a man possessed by a demon, an evil spirit. He cried out at the top of his voice, "Ha! What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," Jesus said sternly. "Come out of him." Then the demon threw the man down before them all and came out without injuring him. Flip a few pages over to Luke chapter 8 with me, if you would, as well. Starting in verse 27. It says, "When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, 'What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me.' For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken the chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places." Then Jesus engages further and casts out that demon or the many that are there. Similarities aren't hard to see, right? I mean, we don't have to be like A-plus biblical scholars to say, huh, in all three of these scenarios, all recorded by Luke, we see some kind of dark, demonic activity, but the demon has better theology than most people. The demon knows exactly who Jesus is, knows exactly what Jesus' association with God the Father is, knows exactly what kind of power Jesus wields, and is completely aware because of reality of where the power that that demon wields compares with the power that God wields. And all that demon can do is spit insults and be obnoxious and beg for Jesus to be, I guess, more gentle in casting him out, whatever that means. I don't think this is an accident. I think Luke is absolutely trying to demonstrate a degree of continuity between what some might write off as the folk tales of demonic dark activity in Judea and what some might write off as the folk tales of dark demonic activity in Europe. Do you see the theological thesis that is being advanced? That there is one single enemy that exists no matter where you go in the world. And whether you name that enemy by the names of these old dark deities and their practices or this old folklore over here, it's one source of darkness. And again, what does this one source of darkness have in common, no matter where it manifests geographically? It completely gets that it is not the man. It completely gets that it exists in subservience to a superior being, which is God, and who these spirits can immediately identify as such. It's weird stuff, isn't it? Well, in this case, there's no secret. And verse 18 is one I've scratched my head at all week. I wore this small bald spot I was scratching so much. It was thick and manly like Mike's hair on Monday, and the passage just, it's a pity, it's never coming back. She kept this up for many days. Finally, Paul became so troubled that he turned around and said to the spirit, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to come out of her." At that moment, the spirit left her. Okay, obvious questions, and I'm not going to give you answers because I don't know. Why did it take him so long? Why wouldn't you just lead with that? Oh, it's spiritual darkness. I'm just going to resolve that. But at the same time, this isn't something that he's done a lot of. I mean, Peter confronted Simon Magus. Paul confronted that sorcerer who was on the island where they first went there. So I guess he has some connectedness with this. Maybe Paul thinks it's even to his advantage to have this spirit, who apparently is trustworthy enough for people to throw money at it, acknowledge that these people should be taken seriously. If I had to put forth a theory, that'd be my theory. I think it actually benefited the ministry to have this dark spirit authenticating who these guys represented and the God that they were talking about. But finally, Paul apparently just gets irritated with it. And I picture the scene, like, if this girl was so valuable, would she have been out of the line of sight of her masters who depended on her financially at any point? I would say no. So my guess is you've got these Greek dudes who just follow her around, maybe have her on a leash, literally, who knows? Follow her around and are just delighted by how much she is pestering and interrupting Paul with this same line again and again and again. And Paul, remember, you know how Paul works. He's not one to roll in and, you know, have a kumbaya kind of session. This guy's high logic. He's going to walk in and explain and articulate things. You know what would make that harder? This is if Norm just jumped up the whole time and kept yelling at me about being a representative of the Son of God. Like, I love you, buddy, but it'd just be really frustrating and hard to keep my train of thought. At what point did she go from being maybe helpful to just obnoxious and a joke for the fun of these Greek masters? I don't know. Whatever the case, it crossed some kind of line and Paul was done with it. And the confrontation does not involve tons and tons of wood and barrels of water and complex work with altars like other confrontations between one power and another that we've seen in the Bible. There's no elaborate setup to this whatsoever. It's just like a grouchy college professor who's sick of people's phones going off in class. You know, and the thing about... You were told to turn off your phone. Bring it to me. Now bring it to me. Because if your phone is going to go off in class, I'm going to answer your phone. Gah! Shut up! My bad for the families where you don't say that. That's what it feels like to me. Like, I'm making a point. This impatience finally boils over, and that's it. That's it. Now think about that moment. If you are a first century audience member who understands that the gods of the Greeks, who are also, by the way, the gods of the Romans, they slap different names on them, but same people, and your understanding is that the source of spiritual power that is most recognizable and tangible, the place where you can go and get it in the physical world, is to go to the temple dedicated to the son of the Most High God, Apollo, and to allow his priestesses to demonstrate the power of God through the spirit of his son, Apollo. If you think that is the most powerful spiritual presence on earth, and then the chief representative of that belief in your community gets... shut down with that, what just happened? See, if you're an original audience member, what this means is the Son of God, the God of Abraham, just flicked aside the most powerful spiritual presence you were aware of on earth with a passing comment out of the side of his mouth during a lecture, not even from him, but from one of his representatives. This is heavyweight stuff to the people who were reading this in the first place. At that moment, the spirit left her. That's it. No writhing, no convulsing, no big speech, nothing. Maybe Paul just went back and finished what he was saying. When the owners of the slave girl realized that their hope of making money was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to face the authorities. This sounds ridiculous. What are going to be the charges? Like, from a distance, you told someone to be quiet and knock it off while talking with other people? We live in a pretty litigious society where people get their feelings hurt and sue over really dumb things. Even that, I don't think, would have any merit, even in our culture. It's nonsense. So, what's their gripe? Well, their gripe is they lost control over a slave. They were exploiting another person, owning them, and making them do horrible, dark things for their profit. She got nothing, no cut, definition of slave. And now someone ruined their gig. They went from having a great time and laughing it up at their expense to all of a sudden, what? Do it again. Do the thing again. She can't do the thing again. Do the thing again. She can't do the thing again. well, then these people need to be flogged. So that's what they're going to do. And they drag him to the marketplace to face the authorities. Now, before we go further, who would the authorities be here again? Macedonian authorities? Greek authorities? Roman authorities. Because Philippi, very important detail that we got early in this narrative, is a Roman colony. So what Luke is doing there is a little bit of a Chekhov's gun. You know the Chekhov's gun? You know this technique? If you're watching a movie or reading a book and the person directing it notes that there's a gun hanging on the wall when someone walked in, the gun is going to come into play later. That's how good writing works. If they didn't mention it and all of a sudden a gun just appears, it doesn't make any sense. If they do mention it and then nothing happens with it, why did you mention the gun? Well, Luke, why did you mention that Philippi was a Roman colony? Aha. First century reader would have known this is coming. They're going to run into trouble with the Romans. So here we are. These are the Roman authorities who are speaking to this now. We haven't really run into the Roman authorities in a confrontational way since Jesus. Well, let's see if things go better this time around. They brought them before the magistrates, verse 20, and said, "These men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice." Wait a second. Whoa, 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 whoa. Weren't they doing that before? Like, the day before? Weren't they? I mean, if this is the gripe with these people, haven't they been doing this for weeks? Why are you just addressing this concern now? Oh, I think I know. Because it has nothing to do whatsoever with your precious Roman customs or how much you love Rome and celebrate Rome. It has everything to do with the fact that they just busted up your racket. They just liberated someone who was in spiritual shackles, and now you don't get money for it, and now all of a sudden you care so deeply about the empire. These people are a real threat to the empire, and that's the problem here. You know who this sounds like? It sounds like the people who accused Jesus, doesn't it? You know who else it sounds like? It sounds like the people who accused Stephen, doesn't it? Think about those two sets of accusations. When people came and accused Jesus, their gripe to the Romans was rebels. This guy is a dangerous rebel who wants to overthrow Rome, which sounds just like what Jesus said, right? Or not at all. And what's the gripe with Stephen when those Greek accusers show up and accuse him before the Sanhedrin? This guy, blaspheming Moses, wants to overthrow the whole legal system. He's a rebel. Apparently accusing people of being rebels had the same kind of currency of as it does today. If you can find a way to twist it around to label somebody a terrorist who's really not, well, yeah, if you watch that program, I think the terrorists win. Oh, that language gets exhausting. You got your actual terrorists, and then you got all the people who are just lumped in with that because it gives you good political capital to just eliminate them. That seems to be the plan here. What? Rebels? That's the buzzword. You know what happens if we have rebellions in our town where we govern? We lose our status as a Roman colony. Well, we can't have that. We should flog. The crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. That went nuclear fast. Now, as Paul is enduring this, I'm guessing that he is remembering that time when he got struck blind on the road to Damascus, and then he had a vision, and then Ananias had a vision, and then he had some more visions, and Ananias had some more visions, and part of that series of visions was Jesus saying that he was going to show Paul how much he was going to have to suffer for his name. This is not news to Paul. He's already taken a pretty serious beating for following Jesus. And now he's taking another one. I'm sure he wasn't just enjoying it, but I'm sure he wasn't surprised. And I'm sure it was something he was prepared to endure. Apparently, we'll be looking at a culture. They were so sure of the presence of the supernatural and some of the dark, weird things that came along with that, that they felt like it was completely appropriate to employ the force of government to coerce and correct people who had committed spiritual violations in the supernatural, spiritual realm. Make of that what you will, but these smart people who could figure out atomic theory without a scanning electron microscope, who could figure out the shape and curvature of the earth without advanced calculation, also thought that there was something to this sufficient that it could be punished by law. I don't know. And we're not going to get to the end, and I'm not going to explain it to you, because I don't know. this does not compute with my general understanding of the world. So I'm not going to pretend that it does and say a bunch of dumb stuff. I'll just say a bunch of dumb stuff while I'm not pretending that it does. So, yeah, apparently it's a big enough deal that being stripped and beaten is a completely reasonable response. After they'd been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Upon receiving such orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks, Chekhov's gun. Why would we need to know that the feet were specifically in stocks? Wouldn't it be enough to just say they got thrown in jail? Unless their feet being in stocks was going to be a crucial detail in the ensuing story, which it will be, and we'll get to that next week. Here's the thing. On the one hand, I think it is very much worth our time, even if we cannot come to hard and fast, scientifically demonstrated conclusions, to seriously consider a passage like this. To pause, to genuinely be reminded, and to acknowledge that even though we might not see it, the Bible does teach that what we struggle against with the human condition and in this life is not just bad choices that people make or destructive things about the world, that there is legitimately an element of spiritual darkness and oppression that the scriptures assign specifically at moments to Satan, the enemy. That God has an enemy, a weaker enemy, a flawed enemy, a limited enemy, who God ultimately will completely defeat. And the only reason God doesn't defeat this enemy right now is because he's prolonging the time of redemption, that more people would respond to him. But in verse 10 of Ephesians chapter 6, it says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms." The book of Ephesians was written by Paul to people who were a part of the same culture as the one he's interacting with in Philippi. To them, he wasn't speaking code. He's saying, look, we all know there is a spiritual presence in this world that is not the God who I am here representing. And you need to understand, it's real, and it's a legitimate concern, and part of your struggle is that. I am highly suspicious of those churches, those Christian leaders, who would act like there is a formula in the Bible for how all of this works. I defy you. It isn't in there. And you have got to read the Bible in some crazy ways, setting some crazy precedents to try to extract out of it some sort of formula for how if you pray this way or that way, then this kind of spirit who has these magic powers will be defeated by your magic prayer. I mean, that's the X-Men. That's a completely different thing. That's comic book stuff. It isn't in here. There is one repeated set of themes throughout the Bible when it comes to this stuff. Darkness is a real thing. It has a personality behind it, and it has an agenda. God beats it and is better than that every time. And ultimately, God will demonstrate complete and total mastery over that and will crush under his boot heel all of this source of evil and all of the expressions of spiritual evil that go with it. That's like that. This is like this. Further, our response is to resist it and not entertain it. So, some people would say, 1, 2, 3, got it. Don't read Harry Potter. What? Huh? What? I guess don't if you'd rather not. But some people, in an effort to try to make some kind of sense of these encounters with darkness, will just say, oh, fiction's the problem. You got to look out for certain types of fiction. Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's up to you. Use good judgment. I don't see a clear command in the Bible to read this and not read that and watch this movie and don't watch this movie. What I see is that we're just supposed to be clearly aligned with the light. We're supposed to be clearly and irrefutably, unmistakably aligned with the agenda of God, with the son of the God of Abraham, not with the son of some other lesser God. Where do those other things get their power? I assume it's either a fraud or it's the power of darkness, the enemy of God. So we steer clear. Clearly this Macedonia thing seems to have been the right place to go, though. lost in all of this discussion that I've put before you about the supernatural world and weird, dark, spiritual stuff is one simple, beautiful part to this story. There's a little girl who's literally a slave, exploited in some of the darkest ways you can imagine, and by the power of Jesus, she was liberated from that spiritual oppression. Did these people continue to own her? Probably, but that's on them. So that's pretty cool. We don't know exactly what her response was, but this Macedonia thing seems like the right place to be, if nothing else, for that little girl. Further, the continued theme of Luke about Jesus and the Holy Spirit showing up and conquering conquerors is developed further. And Macedonia seems to be a great stage to play that theme out further. So it's making sense that way. And third, even though we're not to this part of the story yet, the resistance they're running into is going to set them up, is going to put them in a position for God to do something incredible and irrefutable that I think will ultimately be the event that builds the European church. And that's coming up in the next passage. So, yeah, it looks like this is where they were supposed to be. Nothing's hopping in Asia Minor. Well, a lot's hopping in Philippi. A further thing that I take from a passage like this is a reminder of what we probably don't need to be reminded of very much, but the world is a mess. My goodness, can this place get weird? The extent to which people will exert force and manipulation over other people to control them and abuse them, it seems to be limitless. The things that I see in the news, and often the news just won't cover it, and I'm not sure why, but the things that ISIS does in public, who are these people? I'm reminded of passages like this one in Ephesians 6. Feels like we're fighting a bunch of radical, insane, murderous Muslim guys, and I suppose on paper we are, but you got to understand, this reminder matters. We're fighting against a spiritual darkness that ultimately God will defeat, but right now, if it's staggering and intimidating and scary and just impossible to wrap your brain around, well, that's the kind of chaos and insanity that comes from the father of lies and that comes from such darkness. But you don't have to go to Syria right now to encounter this stuff. Just look at the way we treat each other. Look at the way things are in this once somewhat unified country. I mean, weird. We're trigger happy. Disagree with somebody, it means you hate them. Call people out for not thinking all the same stuff. We're not very good at the live and let live thing anymore. And because we can't figure out how to live and let live with our neighbor, well, we're just going to use the force of the media and politics and manipulation to make people be the way we need them to be, or they're never going to work in this town again. It feels like half the country would be just fine with running the other half into the ground if that was what it took to get ahead, and the other half would be fine with the same thing. That's not just because we can be jerks sometimes. That's darkness. It's a dark view of each other inspired by a dark figure that wields actual power in this world, even if we don't see it in magical, miraculous ways. It's there. And if you believe the Bible that tells us stuff about God, you got to believe that this darkness and this evil is also part of the deal. So the world is a mess, but even in a little passage like this, we are encouraged, and please, even if you're checking out and you're just like, oh, three more minutes, let's get done, you got to stay with me for this point. So just come back with me. Good, here. God wins. God wins. God wins. God wins. God is more powerful than all of this mess. This stuff freaked me out when I was a kid. I read This Present Darkness by Frank Peretti, which is pure unbridled speculation and fiction. But I didn't know that. I didn't know enough about the Bible, so I just assumed that it was like that. I was terrified. The demons were everywhere and trying to control me and ruin things. And finally, I talked to my dad about it, and he clarified, like, but you're Christian, dude. Oh, yeah. It's good. Like, you have sonship. You're a child of the God who has this completely under control and will crush this enemy. Don't freak out. It's not that this doesn't matter. You shouldn't think about it, but you don't have anything to panic about here. So, I know there are a bunch of you here who are my age when I read that book, or even a little younger, who are hearing this stuff. You might be thinking, that's really scary, and maybe I should worry about that. And, like, what if those forces of darkness try to mess with me? Well, the God who you worship is much more powerful. And it didn't take me much thinking about that to realize that I didn't have anything to worry about. I didn't have anything to panic about. And that God was my protector. And that kind of spiritual darkness and bad things that go along with that, that's not what God has in store for me. Because the part of me that would be accessible to that is replaced by the presence of the Holy Spirit, the presence of God himself. On the one hand, yeah, we need to acknowledge that that darkness exists. On the other, we also need to relax a little bit and just know, okay, we stand in opposition to that. We'll do what we can, but the God who we represent has got this completely whipped. This stuff is completely under control, and Acts 16 is a beautiful reminder that to God, all of this seemingly overwhelming evil is, shut up! And that's it. And that's it. He took down an institution, called out an institution that, incidentally, really did pretty much die off shortly after this incident, the worship of Apollo and the Oracle. It went away. Plutarch's a historian who about 20, 30 years after this happened wrote a lamenting book about how the oracles just suddenly don't matter anymore. Why would that be, Plutarch? I think because God flicked the thing aside right here and everybody started to realize it was a joke. And the conquest, both spiritually and physically, of the gospel proceeded. God is more powerful. He's got this thing. And finally, a God that's that powerful also has the power to redeem, which is the far more impressive skill. We love salacious stuff. We love to read about vampires and boogeymen, mummies and pyramids and space aliens that maybe built the pyramids, because that stuff's all interesting. We want to watch our X-Files and guess what made this magic-looking thing happen or that magic thing happen, because it's fun. It's a fun exercise. You know what's not quite as fun but is way more important? Is looking into the lives of ourselves and other people who are flawed and broken and needed redemption, and God made it happen. That is what all of this stuff is about. That is what all of this is supposed to point to. We're not supposed to come away from a passage like this obsessed with darkness and danger and spirits. No, we're supposed to come away from this saying, well, okay, apparently there is another side to this thing that's far weaker, but God crushes it. How do we know? We see it in the lives of people. We see it in the lives of other people who God has redeemed. We see it in our own life. We see what God can do in taking that which is broken and messed up, sometimes really messed up, and forgive it and restore it and give it a hope and a destiny and a future. And everybody in here who knows Christ, that's your story and that's your deal. That's what you're supposed to take from this. In the previous passage, God casually redeemed Lydia. Quietly, invisibly, nothing miraculous appearing about it, just opened her heart so she would respond to the gospel. Well, that's how he does things. In this passage, he dramatically and in a moment of spiritual showdown defeated the forces of darkness and brought redemption to whatever degree to someone who was in a total train wreck position. Your story might be somewhere in the middle on that spectrum. But either way, look, the conclusion is the same. The world's insane and reckless and unjust and not entirely motivated to be those things just by human selfishness. There's a force of evil behind all of it, but God is more powerful and redeems anyway, gradually flicking aside one bit of that darkness after the other. Even the ugliest stuff is redeemed, and ultimately all of that will be snuffed out and drowned out in the light of his glory and his perfection. That's what we're supposed to take with us, and that's what we're supposed to remember as we take communion, which we're going to do right now.